this is a special podcast of the National Secular Society's Secularism 2012 conference, which took place on the 22nd of September 2012. This podcast is brought to you by The Pod Delusion, which is a weekly news magazine podcast about interesting things. From politics to science to culture, all from a sceptical, rationalist, pro-secularist point of view. You can find out more about The Pod Delusion at poddelusion.co.uk. In this podcast, we'll hear from Pragna Patel, who is a secular campaigner, a founding member of the Southall Black Sisters, and the co-founder of Women Against Fundamentalism. In 2010, Pragna received the Irwin Prize for Secularist of the Year on behalf of Southall Black Sisters. And here she is, talking at the conference.
It's an absolute pleasure and an honour to be invited to this conference to discuss what I think to be one of the most urgent and probably most difficult challenge that we all face, which is the challenge to stop or prevent the shrinking of secular spaces at all levels of public life. The title of this conference is Challenging Religious Privilege in Public Life. And Peter has just stolen my first few lines. I was going to say that it is both shocking and surreal, to say the least, to stand here in 2012 talking about the need to challenge the role of religion at the public table. We took the secular fabric of the public institutions and the largely secular public culture that exists in this country for granted, I think. I did not think that we would be adding the struggle for progressive secular spaces and secular values to the long list of struggles against inequality and injustice and for democracy that we then faced. But here I am, discussing one of the most urgent challenges that we all face, one that involves countering the rise of the religious right, in particular, in all communities, at the same time as challenging the accompanying rise in racism towards minorities, especially Muslims. In the time that I have, I cannot do justice to a discussion to both of these areas of struggle, but I would like to stress that the pursuit of human rights and its claims to universality will be futile if we do not at the same time challenge authoritarian and hierarchical systems of power that subjugate and infantilize others on the basis of race, ethnicity, religion, or indeed any other category, including gender, sexuality, and disability. Having said that, I, of course, will want to focus on the issue of secularism in particular and its implications for the women that I work with, black minority, especially South Asian women, and their struggles for equality. So in the last few decades or so, it's becoming clear that religion increasingly has a stake in politics. Even in this country, where it is assumed that religion has been formally relegated to the private sphere, it has never been absent from politics, not really. However, this lack of separation of church and state has come back to bite with a vengeance. It has provided the space for religion, particularly Christianity, to encroach upon public institutions. The result of this lack of separation is that we now see a noticeable upsurge, not only of the Christian right, but also of radical and fundamentalist groups in other religions seeking to transform society along religious norms. It is, of course, a phenomenon that we are witness to the world over. I think I perhaps at this stage should make it clear what I mean by secularism. By secularism, I do not mean anti-religion. But my call, and SBS's call for a secular state, which Britain isn't, does presuppose the need to ensure that there is a separation of religion from political power. This means that the rule of law and other essential political, legal, and civil society institutions and their functions should not be informed by patriarchal and anti-democratic religious values that are highly discriminatory and divisive in practice. Secularism in itself does not guarantee equality or democracy, and history tells us this quite clearly. But it is an important precondition. And that is why the demand for a secular state must also be tied to the demand for democracy, a democracy that is meaningful in that it enhances rather than hinders access to fundamental rights and freedoms. So now I sort of want to come back to a little bit to the SBS experience. In the UK, religion is increasingly being used as a tool to reshape relations and the social contract between the state and minority communities. Needless to say, this development has very specific consequences for all progressive struggles, but especially for those waged by minority women, whose bodies have become the battleground for the control of community representation. Over the last two decades, the British state has vigorously promoted a religious or faith-based approach to minorities, notwithstanding the often contrary and assimilationist tendencies of successive government agendas on cohesion, integration, big society, and localism. I was interested to see that the first speaker of the day was Ted Cantell, and he was, I think, instrumental in promoting a very integrationist approach. But it is an approach which I found was highly flawed in respect of minorities. This faith-based agenda is partly to do with a perceived need to appease conservative religious leaderships within those communities to keep them on side, as it were, for the war on terror. But it's partly promoted in the belief that the right to manifest religion signifies equal treatment of minorities. And it's a belief that's actually shared by sections of the so-called progressive left. Our experience of working on the rights of minority women in the UK reveal that wherever the religious right are in the ascendancy, the right to manifest religion always overshadows the right to freedom from religion. And of course, this reflects a number of economic, social, political, global, national trends. But the result is, in any event, an ever-diminishing welfare state and a corresponding increase in the communalization of minority communities, with community groups and civil society organizing solely around religious identity. The faith-based approach to minorities, as driven as it is by ideological and economic imperatives, is in effect a political resource used by the state and the religious right within minority populations to gain power and privilege. In this context, it is in this context that I say the struggle for human rights by many black and minority women in the UK is now inextricably linked to the struggle for secular spaces. And such struggles have taken on a sense of urgency. The turning point in compelling feminist organizations like Southall Black Sisters to make explicit the link between gender equality and secularism was, of course, the Rushdie affair. And it's obviously a very topical moment now, right now, with his autobiography coming out. But that moment represented the growing power of religious fundamentalists who used the then multicultural and now multi-faith terrain to pursue a vigorous desecularization agenda. The early 90s saw the rise of the religious right in all religions in the UK, and that created the conditions for the emergence of a culture of intolerance, a culture of fear and censorship that remains with us in heightened and incendiary forms. Since the 90s, we have witnessed with alarming frequency religious fundamentalist and authoritarian protests to any form of dissent from an imposed religious identity, much of which has centered directly and indirectly on the control of women's sexuality. Nor are such protests confined to Muslims only. Hindus, Sikhs, Christians, in the majority community too, have sought to impose strict religious identity on followers by clamping down on dissent. The furor created around the play Besti in 2005, if many of you remember, is an example of one of the many attempts by the religious right, in this case the Sikh right, to suppress dissent. And that involves silencing minority women who dare to speak out against religious and cultural impositions that undermine their freedom and rights. For those of you who remember, the Besti play, the furor involved protests by Sikh fundamentalists, but also so-called moderates, against the play, which basically means dishonor, and it dealt with the issues of rape and abuse of power within a Sikh temple. And the Sikh, so-called Sikh community took offense and protested and had the play removed from the Birmingham Rep company. And the play, the author had to go into hiding. That's just one example. I can quote you many, many more that don't even make the headlines. We in SBS are aware also of countless cases around the country where South Asian and other minority women have been prevented from voicing their thoughts and prevented from exercising self-determination. Religious institutions have been involved or condoned domestic and sexual violence and abuse within minority communities. There have even been cases where religious leaders have sought to exorcise women or children by beating them, sometimes to death, for nonconformist behavior perceived as possession by evil spirits. And last week, there was one such a report of a woman who was, with the collusion of the local imam, was beaten by her family, who thought that she was possessed by evil spirits, and that was in Bethnal Green, I think. So whilst these cases represent the more dramatic end of the spectrum, women find their aspirations quashed by religious leaders on a day-to-day basis. They often find themselves trapped at home because of the stranglehold of culture and religion. And as minority women in the UK have no effective political representation and no power to challenge the hegemony of the religious establishments, they, along with other subgroups, have the most to lose. Women have only their voices of dissent as a tool by which to demand more freedom. The suppression of dissent is therefore not just a question of freedom of expression, but literally a matter of life and death for many. This is precisely why we supported Salman Rushdie, and why we also opposed the creation of the new offence of incitement to religious hatred in 2005. We perceived it as an attempt to introduce the outdated blasphemy laws through the back door, and argued that the main targets would not be those engaged in fomenting religious hatred toward others, but those who wish to dissent from religion itself. In other words, those representing a challenge to orthodox traditions, such as women, gays, and lesbians. Our fears were confirmed when a spokesperson from the Sikh so-called Human Rights Commission, who in response to the Besti affair, stated on television that if the law had existed at the time, the group would have used it to prevent the play from being performed. The state's faith-based agenda has given a further fillip to fundamentalists and religious right forces who are in the process of consolidating their power and control over communities and resources. Partly in response to the rise of anti-Muslim racism, many Muslims, including Muslim women, are becoming increasingly vigilant in their efforts to protect religious identity. And this has resulted in a series of demands for greater religious recognition in public spaces. Dominant demands for legal tolerance, cultural rights, and access to public resources, evident for example, campaigns to extend the blasphemy law, funding for religious schools, dress codes, and the right to apply customary or personal religious laws in the governance of family affairs instead of civil law, are just some examples. And not to be outdone, other minority groups, predominantly Hindus and Sikhs, have followed suit, demanding that their educational welfare and family needs also need to be addressed in accordance with their religious values. Such demands use the language of human rights and even anti-racism, but actually what they're doing is subverting these very principles, so stripping them off their progressive meaning. Their demands seek not only to alter public culture, but to strengthen the control of women in the private sphere. What is particularly troubling about all of this is that these demands have been taken to represent a strong counter-hegemonic voice to so-called Western cultural and religious imposition. And to that extent, at all levels of society, minority rights are increasingly and almost exclusively linked to the right to manifest religion. And our concern at SBS is that in the process, the state is unable to distinguish between valid demands for equality and those that simply mask and perpetuate inequality. Instead, the state happily obliges by promoting and funding multi-faith forums and projects at central and local government levels to tackle all sorts of social problems, even where those involved in such forums have had no historical and have no interest in gender equality or social justice and human rights issues. Most are only concerned to ensure that the demand for equality is substituted for the demand for more religious literacy in all public institutions. That is, they demand that the state recognizes their supposedly authentic theological values and traditions of minorities, but they don't want to, and they erase, in fact, the diverse, syncretic, liberal, cultural, political, secular traditions, including feminist traditions, within communities. And it is a demand which elements of the progressive left are all too willing to accommodate. For the sake of clarity, and so that there's no misunderstanding, I need to stress that equality and human rights are not Western concepts. The struggle for equality and human rights by black minority women against religious and patriarchal authority in the UK, and indeed by women and others across the world, show that they are waged on a daily basis, often simultaneously with struggles against Western imperialism and racism, that is also troubling because it's increasingly linked to Christian evangelism. The feminist and human rights scholar Karima Benoun, who is based in the US, has stated that the struggle to keep religion and the law separate is one of the most urgent struggles that is now taking place globally. This is certainly true of our struggles as minority women in the British context, where the gains that we have made in compelling the state to fulfill its obligations as the guarantor of human rights are increasingly under threat. Although the state has begun to assert more clearly that harmful cultural practices, such as forced marriage, honor-based violence, will not be tolerated, and that in itself is a legacy of our short-lived attempt to create a mature multiculturalism, the faith-based approach contributes to a set of contradictory policies and practices aimed at recognizing and protecting religious identity, increasingly to the detriment of women's rights. For example, on the one hand, the state acknowledges issues such as domestic violence, honor crimes, forced marriage, female genital mutilation, etc., as an abuse of women's human rights, and actively seeks to intervene in its protective capacity. But on the other hand, in the face of the power of religious claims, it fails to acknowledge the lack of ability and the absence of social permission for the more vulnerable and minority communities to exercise choice in determining their culture and religious affiliations, practices, and identity. Yet the emphasis on religious identities in social policy and practice brings with it a number of problems linked to questions of validity and authenticity, questions about which religious identities and demands are valid, and whose opinion constitutes the authentic voice, are matters that are arising in the battles that are now taking place. And this is clearly evident in recent debates and developments in respect of the demand to incorporate aspects of personal laws, Sharia laws, in relation to the family in particular within the English legal system. A move which, unsurprisingly, in an economic context where controlling time-consuming litigation and slashing the legal aid budget is an overriding objective, it's a move that's encouraged by leading establishment figures in the judiciary and the church itself. We conducted a study at Southall Black Sisters to map some of these shifts towards multifaithism and implications on policy and practices towards for minority women. And the findings of that study showed that women absolutely value their right to freedom from aspects of their religion and culture, a freedom which is often seen necessary to secure their right to life, to be free from inhuman and degrading treatment, to choice in marriage, to private life, to freedom of expression, to an education, and to a fair trial. And they also complained of the rise of religious leaders' institutions as providers of services. They felt that it would threaten their access to protection and justice. They cherished the secular space provided by Southall Black Sisters, which they saw as an empowering space, a space that enables them to gain access to other essential secular state welfare and legal services, which actually provide the final safety net when they are at risk of serious harm or their lives. And they were clear that however flawed the secular nature of the state, it did at least enable them to assert their fundamental rights and freedoms in the family. So, yet in spite of the history of achievement of feminist groups like us, and there are many others up and down the country, support for and engagement with religious forums such as the Muslim Arbitration Forum, for example, is gathering pace. On the face of it, formalized religious forums of arbitration, such as the Muslim Arbitration Tribunal, present themselves as professional bodies that seek to adhere to formal legal rules of engagement and to non-discriminatory principles. But what they are in fact seeking to do is create the conditions for the establishment of parallel legal systems based on divine law. Quite apart from the fact that in the UK there is no substantive evidence, as our study showed, that the majority of Muslim or other minority women want religious arbitration in respect of personal and family matters, we actually know from women's experiences of formal and informal religious arbitration systems that they are gender biased and profoundly discriminatory. There is nothing in the operation of these forums to suggest that they are progressive on women's rights, irrespective of what they say publicly and of the views of some of the individuals associated with it. Backing religious forums will therefore, in effect, mean state backing for the most discriminatory and often abhorrent practices to be endorsed. And backing such forums will actually enforce a lack of choice on the most vulnerable within minority communities, especially women and children. In our view, the aim of the Muslim Arbitration Tribunal and other religious tribunals is to present themselves as legitimate mediators on women's issues. But in reality, they attempt to oust the position of feminist organizations that have historically campaigned on gender-related violence and gender equality in the family. The political context, therefore, and the issues of power that flow from demands for separate or parallel legal systems cannot be overlooked. They are made by those who have specific political agendas and who are themselves unrepresentative of and unaccountable to the communities that they claim to represent. So in conclusion, We would say that the duty to exercise due diligence in order to prevent, investigate, punish acts, for example, of violence against women or other violations on women's rights, including those carried out by non-state actors, is a necessary function of a democratic state. In our view, this duty is being subverted by the state's accommodation of demands for personal religious laws to govern family affairs and for greater recognition of religious identity in public institutions. In the final analysis, I suppose the question that has to be asked, but it remains unanswered so far, is why, despite evidence of discrimination and denial of rights, especially for women and sexual minorities, there is such widespread acceptance that family law can be culturally specific rather than subject to universal human rights norms. I think the connection between gender, equality, and religious political movements need to be urgently examined, since it has human rights ramifications for the UK, particularly for the vulnerable in the UK. The current promotion of faith-based projects in all areas of civil society is in danger of compromising the gender equality agenda for black minority women and for sexual minorities in particular. Ultimately, though, there needs to be constant vigilance against the use of women's issues, both by the state and religionists, in pursuit of other agendas. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We've got about 5 minutes for questions. Do we have some questions, please? Right, okay, just take a few. Right, we'll take one. Could one of the stewards please take a microphone to the chap with his arm up over there? Thank you. Can we try another? Is that microphone not working? Could we try another one? Could one of the stewards please get another microphone? Thank you.
Hi, sorry. You mentioned at the beginning of your talk you found Professor Cantle's concept of interculturalism deeply flawed. What do you consider a more viable alternative? Thank you.
Okay. I wasn't here this morning, so perhaps I do him a disservice because I don't know where he's taking this idea of interculturalism. I am aware of the Ted Cantell report, and I'm aware of what it was trying to do, which was to look at the sort of unrest in the northern cities. However, I felt that what was missing, and this is a criticism that's been leveled at the Cantell report, and at the same time that the whole notion of integration and cohesion was kind of being promoted, in fact, off the back of that report, was that he ignored the kind of structural inequalities that gave rise to civil unrest in the northern cities and towns. He ignored the kind of years of deprivation of these areas in terms of unemployment, homelessness, and he ignored, I think, perhaps most importantly, the way in which local politics had been played out in those areas, and where much of the local politics actually constructed the parallel communities that he was talking about and critiquing. But ultimately, the way in which that whole very important seminal moment in this country, in the history of this country, in terms of race relations, was played out, particularly by politicians and by media, was to basically argue that the fault lay with the Asian communities that were seeking parallel, leading parallel lives. It didn't talk about the role of racism and the kind of structural inequalities of unemployment and deprivation that also contributed to the way in which lives were being led in those areas. And instead, it kind of reduced everything to this idea that it was the minority communities who were failing to integrate who were the problem. And on the back of that, we then had this push away from, this backlash against multiculturalism towards cohesion, assimilation, and integration. And in fact, it was those very contradictory set signals being given, because at the same time as promoting this idea of cohesion, the government was also promoting a faith-based agenda. And I'll give you a very concrete example of that, which was that in around 2008, our own organization lost its funding because the local council, and the chief executive of the local council, by the way, was the chair of the Commission for Integration and Cohesion at that time, decided to cut our funding on the basis that specialist groups are no longer needed and that the cause for integration and cohesion is undermined by groups like us. And instead, he said that they needed a generic service for domestic violence, not specialist services for black minority women. And yet, at the same time, the funding that was being made available to that council, both by the Prevent Violent Extremism agenda through that funding stream and through the community cohesion funding stream, was going towards developing and promoting faith-based organizations in our area. And that contradiction in terms of cohesion was simply a glaring one, which I actually think was precipitated by that Cantel report. If he was here, I would have loved to have debated. I don't know what he means by interculturalism. I do know that it led to a backlash against the more positive aspects of multiculturalism, and it led to a situation where some of the gains that we have made in fighting racism and racial inequality were set back. And that kind of contradiction, on the one hand, it was a secular organizations, minority organizations that were being shut, and yet and the process has since accelerated under the big society and localism agenda. The faith-based groups have been promoted and developed, even though they have no, as I said, track record on dealing with issues of human rights, social justice, and equality.
So could you please have a very big round of applause for Pragya Patel.
Thank you.
This was a special podcast brought to you by The Pod Delusion. The Pod Delusion is a weekly news magazine programme about interesting things, from politics to science to culture, all from a sceptical rationalist, pro-secularist point of view. Essentially, if you like what you've just heard, then you'll like our weekly podcast as well. Head over to poddelusion.co.uk to find out more. But for now, thanks for listening.